views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Good morning. My name is Angel Fall, and you are tuned in to Victims to Victorious. The title of today's show is Botham Jean and Joshua Brown, Black Body, White Lie. Follow me on Twitter. My name is On Air Angel. And each and every week on Victims to Victorious, we take a look at incidents of gun violence and how that's affecting the population in America, the culture, policy, and most importantly, how public health issues are established in prevention. So over the weekend, we had some very disturbing news, and I'm going to ask the listeners to listen while I give a little bit about the background of the story. What we're going to talk about is the witness in Amber Geiger's trial was fatally shot. And of course, Amber Geiger was a Dallas police officer, white and female, who opened up her, what she believed to be her apartment door in 2018 and shot an African-American man who was sitting watching TV and eating ice cream. She, of course, has been found guilty of killing him, which is a relief for many of us. But while we were getting that relief, something unfolded the weekend that was terribly disturbing. And I'm going to read from the New York Times. There are several articles about this. And if we have time, I might backtrack a little bit about Amber Geiger if I feel listeners need to be updated. The New York Times writes, "Witness in Amber Geiger's trial is fatally shot," lawyer says. Officials have not publicly identified a motive or suspect in the shooting of Joshua Brown, who provided key testimony about the 2018 killing of Botham Jean by a Dallas police officer. And Botham Jean is an African-American man. A witness who delivered key testimony in the trial of Amber Geiger, the white former Dallas police officer convicted this past week in the murder of an unarmed black man, Botham Jean, was fatally shot on Friday night, a lawyer for Mr. Jean's family said. The witness, Joshua Brown, 28, who had lived in the same apartment complex as Ms. Geiger and Mr. Jean, was shot several times by an unknown assailant, Lee Merritt, the family lawyer, said on Twitter Saturday night. You can follow me on Twitter, On Air Angel. And let's return to the article. Mr. Brown's death occurred just 2 days after a Dallas County jury sentenced Ms. Geiger to 10 years in prison, well short of the maximum 99 years that she could have received in the killing of Mr. Jean, a 26-year-old immigrant from the Caribbean island nation of St. Lucia. The sentence was seen as inadequate by some social justice advocates, We saw the trial as another example of white police officers being held to a different standard than people of color. Mr. Brown was getting out of his car at an apartment complex where he lived when he was shot. Just catching the listeners up, Mr. Brown is the witness in the case. We're not speaking of Botham Jean, who was the victim in the case that Amber Geiger was convicted of killing. Mr. Brown was getting out of his car at an apartment complex where he lived when he was shot, Mr. Merritt said. He said the apartment complex where the shooting happened was not the same one where Mr. Jean had been killed by Ms. Geiger. Mr. Jean is also known as Botham Jean. The shooting, Mr. Merritt said, seems very personal, in quotes. As of Sunday morning, officials had not publicly identified any suspects or motive, but Mr. Merritt said that Mr. Brown had no known enemies, had not been involved in questionable activities, and had not been in the middle of a lover's quarrel. Going to step away from the article. Those are some of the motives that the police always look for. Have you had a recent dispute with a friend, a neighbor, co-worker? Are you in some kind of love triangle that's volatile? So the lawyer for Mr. Merritt, who's also the lawyer for Jean's family, said that Mr. Brown had no known enemies, I'm reading that again, had not been involved in questionable activities, and had not been in the middle of a lover's quarrel. He made his money from Airbnb, he said. He wasn't involved in any gangs. All the usual suspects were kind of counted out. This is me again stepping away from the article. The fact that the first thing they have to do when you're an African-American male victim is determine if you're a gangbanger, as if that has value in terms of your mother's grief or your grandmother's grief or your daughter's grief. Returning to the article, the Dallas Police Department would not confirm that Mr. Brown was the shooting victim. This is as of the publication of the article. But said the officer responded to the Atera Apartments at 4606 Cedar Springs Road around 10:37 p.m. local time Friday for a reported shooting. Dallas Fire Rescue responded and transported the complainant to Parkland Memorial Hospital. Now, those of you who are students of history know that JFK was taken to Parkland Memorial Hospital, where he died from his injuries. The police said several witnesses heard several gunshots and observed a silver four-door sedan leaving the parking lot at a high rate of speed. Police officials say that the victim did not have identification on him. A representative of the Southwestern Institute of Forensic Science, which oversees Dallas County medical examinations and autopsies, said Mr. Brown appeared to have been shot twice. If you just joined us, we're about 10 minutes into Victims to Victorious, and we're discussing how the key witness in the Amber Geiger killing was since shot. Sergeant Mike Mata, the president of the Dallas Police Association, said he didn't believe that the shooting was the result of someone targeting Mr. Brown for his role as a star witness in Ms. Geiger's trial. Any conspiracy theorists that have ever watched a thriller, if you are trying to prevent somebody from testifying, it usually happens before, not after, he said. Sergeant Mata said that such theories minimize the crime problem in Dallas, adding that the city has seen more murders this year in previous years, and violent crime was up. And in the discussion, we're going to talk about some of that. Of course, some of this is linked to our very themes of increasing gun access, because the more people who carry guns, the more people who are likely to use guns, especially when there is a conflict that they would have eradicated in a different way had not a weapon been available. That's one way to look at more guns, more crime. He didn't testify anything damaging, he said. If anything, he personalized, which we already knew, he was an amazing individual. The shooting of Mr. Jean in September 2018 ignited protests and calls for justice, with demonstrations outside police headquarters and inside City Hall. After weeks of community tensions and accusations of preferential treatment for the police, a grand jury came back with an the increased charge of murder. By this time, Ms. Geiger had been fired from the Dallas Police Department. Still reading from the article. During a week-long trial, this will help catch up some of the listeners on the trial. During a week-long trial, prosecutors sought to paint Ms. Geiger as careless and aggressive on the night she had entered someone else's home, pulled her service weapon, and opened fire. Her defense lawyers argued that she had an unfortunate but understandable mistake during a perfect storm of circumstances that ended in tragedy. In testifying about the night of Mr. Jean's fatal shooting, Mr. Brown, now we're talking about Joshua Brown, the 28-year-old witness who has since been shot after he testified against the former Dallas police officer for shooting the unarmed African-American male in his own apartment. Returning to the article, at this time he lived directly across the hall from Mr. Jean in the Southside Flats apartment complex, which is about 5 miles away from the Atera apartments where he was shot. Mr. Brown said he had left his apartment in the hours before Mr. Jean was shot to watch his cousin play for the Atlanta Falcons, and his friend for the Philadelphia Eagles at a local sports bar. Bombshell. He caught a Lyft or Uber back home at halftime and heard two people meeting by surprise as he turned the corner to his apartment. He heard two gunshots and immediately ran away. He testified that he had not heard shouted verbal commands like hands. Mr. Merritt, who represented the Botham family during the trial, the Botham family being the victim, said Mr. Brown's murder underscores the reality of the black experience in America. A former athlete turned entrepreneur, Brown lived in constant fear that he could be the next victim of gun violence, either state-sanctioned or otherwise, he said. Brown deserves the same justice he sought to ensure the Jean family. So we're going to be discussing that, the fact that Joshua Brown became a victim after he testified, and then I'm going to review a little bit more of the Amber Geiger case for people who may not be as familiar with it. If you just tuned in, we're about 15 minutes into Victims to Victorious, broadcasting on Black Talk Radio Network. My name is Angel Fall. We're here every Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. So now I'm going to a New York Times article that I was just reading, a New York Times article about Amber Geiger and what that case was about. If you wish to call in, if you are from Dallas, Texas, and you have feelings about the numbers of murders that have gone up, very much linked to the way the laws have been relaxed over who can carry weapons, how much ammunition you can have, if you can carry weapons in certain places, please do call in. Our phone number is 704-802-5056. Also, all the shows that are produced by Scotty Reed are then archived later on the Black Talk Radio Network. The Black Talk Radio Network hosts other interesting shows that look at the African-American experience, and we have many, many, many shows that you can be interested in. When you click on the tab, click down and look for me. I'm at the bottom, Victims to Victorious. So Amber Geiger was a Dallas police officer who came home one evening, and she said that she opened the door to what she thought was her apartment, only to see an African-American man sitting on a couch watching television. She discharged her service weapon, killing him, and he was named Botham Jean. She did get 10 years, but as we discussed, the sentence could have been 99 years. And of course, there's lots of data about the discrepancy in sentencing. Between 10 and 99 years is highly discretionary, and many social advocates feel that she did not get enough time for having
shot Angel?
Someone. Yes.
Good morning to you, and good morning to the listeners, and do want to let them know if they want to chime in, follow the system instructions, hit ** to unmute yourself. I'll alert Angel that you're on the line in case she doesn't see the board. But I have a question. Just popped into my head as you were speaking about the Amber Geiger case. Now, this was a murder charge, correct?
Yes.
Okay, now we know, I don't know about Texas, and we know she wasn't on federal charges, but I don't know about Texas, but many states have an enhancement of sentence when a gun is used in a violent act. Am I correct about that? Did she get any extra enhanced charges for killing someone with a firearm?
No. In fact, in preparing for the show, there were several jurors who disclosed later that they felt sorry for her.
Okay.
And remember, her defense team says that she's confused. Okay. So her defense team goes so far as to say it's just a mistake. And in listening to social media, you know, let's backtrack. As African-American people, we do have to have some gratitude. I hate to use the word gratitude. The fact that the case was even papered, the fact that since Texas has been a state, it has been a $50 fine. There's actually have been laws on the books to kill an African-American person. And the first white person executed in Texas for killing a black person, this happened during slavery, and a very rich plantation owner had a slave who was killed by a white man, but it was his favorite slave, so he insisted on the death penalty, and that person was killed. Southern states, as a rule, don't have a very good record on applying the maximum sentence for white people who kill blacks. And then there's another piece. She is a woman. Women tend not to be sentenced as long for killing.
I have an answer to that question in case anyone's interested. This comes from RestoreJustice.org. Texas has no specific enhancement for firearm possession or use during the commission of a felony. Again, this was a murder, that first-degree murder. It was a felony, state felony, but Texas has no enhancements, and as Angel pointed out, they recently relaxed gun laws in Texas. So just wanted to share that.
Concealment laws, for instance, and of course, Texas is a state that really needs to look at, we discussed this several times, about the type of weapons you can have, the amount of weapons you can have, and where you can carry them. And instead of tightening this up, they have been loosening it up. And of course, we can see a direct impact between the loosening of the laws and even some of the mass murders that have occurred, Scotty. So I want to thank you for chiming in. And I promised the listeners I would talk a little bit more. I did talk a little bit more about the background of the case, but I also want to talk about the larger concept of murder. And we were discussing that, how Texas has become increasingly more violent. And those of us who are gun advocates, we can prove that relaxing the law and putting more guns in people's hands increases the number of incidents of shooting, and therefore, to use epidemiology language, morbidity and mortality. So the NBC affiliate in Texas has an online article, and it goes back to June 5th. And so some of the shootings are not, some of the shootings we've discussed since August and October are not in this article, but what I like to do from time to time is I like to actually name victims. And one of the things I've noticed in doing the research and preparing for the show, very often the black and brown victims are nameless in the articles. They're nameless in the reporting. Their families don't come forward to be part of it. The other part of it is that the bodies are not identified. And sometimes the bodies are not identified for lots of reasons. There isn't a next of kin. Next of kin is incarcerated. In case of the black and brown people, especially some of the Spanish-speaking people, there may not be someone available to translate. There are all kinds of things that impede the identification. Grief itself, notification. But anyhow, this article takes a look at some of the names of the victims and what's going on in Texas since these laws have been relaxed. I'm reading from the NBCDFW.com. And as of June 5th, 14 have been shot and killed in Dallas. Again, we've seen more shootings since, but I chose this article because it names, it puts a name to some of the victims. As of June 5th, 14 have been shot and killed in Dallas in the last 5 days. Their deaths highlight a violent year in one of the nation's largest cities, where 93 people have been killed this year, including 40 in May alone. So for listeners who are paying attention, Joshua Brown and Botham Jean, of course, are not in this count. Botham Jean is killed by Amber Geiger in 2018, and Joshua Brown's death was before the article was printed. Michael Rodriguez, Kay Arian Taylor, and Leroy Hawkins, all 17, and Malik Tyler, 13, are among the city's youngest and most recent victims. The violence is indicated on a map, so you can send me a direct message on Air Angel, or if you're on your computer, you can go to nbcdfw.com/news/local and type in Dallas 93 murders. So they give a map of where these places occur, and they also give a comparison. 69 people had been killed in the city during the same period in 2018. So imagine that Botham Jean is actually in that count. So 93 and counting as of June 5th. And one of the things I like to remind the listeners of, I'm not so sure what could have prevented Botham Jean from being a victim of Amber Geiger. But we do know for the other young men, and even possibly Joshua Brown, that your risk for being shot can be eliminated or reduced, I should say, can be reduced by several things. There's a lot of data on where the shootings occurred. There's a lot of data on the age of the victims, and of course on the race of the victim. So I just want to, just for the listeners to hear the names of some of the teenage victims killed in the summer this year in Dallas, Texas. Michael Rodriguez, Kay Arian Taylor, Leroy Hawkins, and Malik Tyler. And Malik was only 13 years old. If you just tuned in, it's 11:25 a.m. My name is Angel Fall. We are broadcasting on the Black Talk Radio Network. The name of the show is Victims to Victorious, and we have begun the show by taking a look at the suspicious, unusual, unfortunate, don't know what to call it, circumstances surrounding a key witness's death. And his name is Joshua Brown. If you want to chime in, you can call 704-802-5056. Listen to the prompts, and my sound engineer will get you on the air. Let's go back to magnifying a little bit of the article concerning the articles concerning Amber Geiger and connecting them to some of the sentiments of the jury. This is from CNN. And this article is cnn.com/2019. You can find it this way, 10/04/US Amber Geiger. So Anderson Cooper actually interviews two of the jurors. Now, one of the things that people should be noting is that there are black jurors. Why is that important? Many, many times in America, especially down south, African American people were precluded from serving on juries because they were also precluded from voting. So there are black jurors on this jury, and of course, I could imagine that her defense attorneys probably did not want them there. But giving a little bit of background about the sentencing and the jury, and Scotty brought up some subjects tangential to that. Sentencing former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger to 10 years for the fatal shooting of her neighbor Botham Jean was one of the hardest things jurors ever had to do, two of them told ABC's Good Morning America. Ultimately, after hearing about Jean's forgiving nature, they couldn't bring themselves to sentence Geiger to the full 28 years behind bars that the prosecutors asked for. So Scotty wanted to know, was there a special enhancement, and no, there isn't in Texas, for using a gun in the commission of a felony. Her sentence could be, as I read earlier, from 10 to 99 years. So the prosecutor had asked for 28 years behind bars. Two of the jurors said, there's no way that we could ever know what he would want. One of them, a white man, said in an interview that aired Friday, but I think we all had to make a decision that we could live with and that our conscience could be sound with. Jean, a 26-year-old black man, died after Geiger, a 31-year-old white woman, entered his apartment and shot him. She said she mistook Jean's apartment, which was one floor above hers, for her own, and that she believed that she was an intruder. Two of the jurors in Amber Geiger's trial spoke to ABC's Good Morning America. Some believe the sentence was too lenient. I mentioned that earlier. Jean's mother said Thursday that the life of her son was worth more than a 10-year sentence that Geiger received. Many tears were shed while deciding the sentence, the juror said. But after hearing about Jean and the kind of caring and forgiving person he was, the jurors, who were unnamed, wanted to reflect that in their decision. I was like, I can't give her 20 years, the other juror, black woman, said. I know a lot of people are not happy about the 10 years, but I felt like you can't compare the case to any of those other officers killing an unarmed black man. So what they were talking about are shootings, police-sanctioned shootings. Those officers, when they get out, they went back to living their lives. Amber Geiger, ever since she killed the man, she's not been the same, she explained. She showed remorse and that she was going to have to deal with this the rest of her life. I don't think Bo would want to take harsh vengeance, said the male juror. I think he would want to forgive her. So we'll come back and look at some of the juror's sentiments on this after the station ID for blacktalkradionetwork.com. My name is Angel Fall, and you're listening to Victims to Victorious.
Podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Okay, it's 11:31 a.m. If you wish to join the discussion on Victims to Victorious, the phone number is 704-802-5056. My name is Angel Fall, and you're listening to Victims to Victorious. Returning to the CNN article that is partially transcribed from an interview on CNN for Mr. Cooper. What's his first name? Anderson. So returning to the article, I think Bo would want to take harsh vengeance. I don't think Bo would want to take harsh vengeance, said the male juror. That's where I stopped. I think he would want to forgive her. And of course, her here is Amber Geiger. It was a display of forgiveness that helped the jurors feel that they ended up with the right sentence, he said. Jean's 18-year-old brother hugged Geiger in the courtroom on Wednesday, and you can see video of that where he hugged her, and clearly he felt that she needed forgiveness and he was offering atonement. You can see a picture of the victim's brother hugging her on CNN.com. And after the airing of the show, I think I will tweet that. One thing that Botham can teach us is that we should all love each other instead of hate each other, the woman told ABC. I honestly think that if Botham would have just got shot and not killed, I think he would have forgiven Amber Geiger. So one of the things I've noticed in preparing for the show is a lot of people are wondering, how is it that you walk into your apartment, which you believe is your apartment, and you see someone else there and you just don't shut the door and back up? Remember, the victim now of a homicide, Joshua Brown, he says he doesn't hear her say anything like hands up. And I'm also curious as to why we don't hear her say that she said anything like, what are you doing in my apartment? Certainly, I think those of us who have traveled or moved someplace or been someplace unfamiliar, we all have not had the reaction of grabbing a sidearm. So people who want to get rid of guns, their argument here would be, had she not had a gun, it never would have happened. And of course, that's true. But she is an armed, at the time of the shooting, she is an armed police officer, and therefore she does have the weapon. She does have the sidearm on her person. But what about her conflict resolution skills? What about her acknowledging that she'd actually made a mistake as soon as she opens the front door? Then another question I have is, what type of burglar sits down and eats a bowl of ice cream while watching television? I mean, that's a very fair question. So Amber Geiger is the subject of our show, and her first victim, Botham Jean, and then, as related to the case, the victim Joshua Brown, who testified that he had not heard her say any of the police commands. So for people who believe wholeheartedly that this is part of a conspiracy, I really would like for you to call in and let us know what you're thinking about that. So the call in is 704-802-5056. So one of the things that I do on Victims to Victorious is I talk about public health models that can be used to prevent shootings. So some of you might be wondering, you know, how does this fit into today's show? Well, one of the things that we do know is that every country in the world does not have an armed police force like we do in the United States of America. And so for many years, the British police officers did not carry guns. They were notorious for carrying billy clubs. So we know that, and so places where the police don't carry guns, they have to conflicts differently. So obviously, here in the United States of America, and especially in Texas, where it feels like they want everyone to be armed, they carry weapons, and that was her choice. It was her choice to pull the weapon on the African American person who she believed she was in her apartment. And I have a question for the listeners. Had she not had a gun, what would she have done? She probably would have called the police. Okay. She probably would have called the police. But what would have the outcome been if she still believed that that was her, if that was her apartment?
Can I answer?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Daddy.
She would have probably had time to recognize that, hey, this big giant red mat in front of my door, where did that come from? And, oh, this ain't my apartment. So, and another thing I like to point out, Angel, is she testified that she took de-escalation training, but she also testified that she could recall nothing. So when I heard one of the attorneys or parties speaking for the family on that day at a press conference, and one of them said, we need de-escalation training, I'm like, were you not paying attention? She had de-escalation training, but apparently she didn't pay attention. And I also did a podcast on this, comparing it to my experience in the military and being a person at my last duty station that was in charge of the entire battalion and making sure that the soldiers were tested every year as it relates to their particular skills they needed for whatever their job title was. That's what MOS means, job title. And okay, if you did not pass, you could be getting put out the Army. You might get a second chance to pass. If you didn't, you'll be getting put out. It's also, you know, your score is also figuring into your promotions. So from what I understand, she got that training one time and it did not stick. I think that's relevant.
So let me ask you, as someone who has disclosed to the listeners, that you are a gun owner, had you been faced with her scenario and you happen to have one of your sidearms on you and you live in a state where you can, where this is legal, had you been she, Scotty, what would you have done if you opened the door?
Well, I can tell you, I had an experience.
Opened the door and you found a white woman sitting on the couch eating ice cream and watching television.
I would have asked her, what you doing in my house? but listen, I had two experiences. It wasn't inside the house, but it was on the property and next door at the church. And this, the first one was, I was on my back porch and this white guy comes stumbling across our yard into the back of our yard. I'm on the back porch. He doesn't even see me. Walks right past me. I'm thinking, this dude looking for something to steal. So I ain't say anything. I didn't shoot him on the spot like we've seen some cases, you know, of civilians just shooting. I can't remember the young lady's name who knocked on somebody's door who had a car accident and the homeowner shoots through the door. So I didn't do anything but watch this boy. And then he stumbles over to the trailer park, which is on the other side of the church. So I ain't shoot him. You know what I'm saying? I just deserve. Then, now when the churches were being burnt down, there was a rash of church burnings. This was around the time of Dylan Roof killed those people at Emmanuel, those parishioners or congregants at Emmanuel. So I'm on high alert. I'm staying up at night and I'm every hour going to check the church. So I see this white boy pulls up in a van behind the church. Okay, so I'm thinking, okay, somebody trying to break in the church or they about to try to burn the church down. So I got a stick. I have a gun. I got a stick and a dog, our dog we had at the time. And I went over there and I asked him, what are you doing? As it turns out, he lived in the trailer park too. His wife had been drinking and he was wanting to take the van the SUV. And so he was trying to hide it from her. And I just simply told him, Man, all these churches being burnt down. I ain't never seen you before. I don't know who you are. You need to move. And he left. I saw him and his wife the next day driving down the road, and they both looked over at me. I was sitting on the front porch and waved. So is that kind of like a similar circumstance that it could have turned into somebody getting killed?
Yeah, it certainly does. But you also, you didn't go as far as she did. It also makes me wonder, and I don't, that doesn't come out in the trial. Watch some of the trial. We don't see her, you know, shooting anyone while she's a police officer. But what I do wonder is that had she been confronted with an African-American man doing anything, would she have pulled her weapon and shot him on a traffic stop? A complainant in a dispute. It does make me suspicious about her demonization of a person of color.
Well, she was. Yes. She did post racist text messages, exchange racist text messages between herself and her partner, married with children, that she was having an affair with, and he had shot an unarmed black person and killed and was not charged. Now, also, a lot of people have not mentioned, I mentioned it in my podcast, the Plain View Project, scoured the social media profiles of about six or seven police departments in the United States. The Dallas Police Department was one of them. They found racist and violent posts about even killing people. I wear black because I'm already dressed for your funeral was one post that Amber Geiger liked. And so 104 officers out of the 700, almost 800 officers at Dallas PD, 104 were documented. That's just the ones that was documented. Others could have had private profiles or what have you and weren't so dumb as to post public messages like that. Only 24 of the officers is under investigation in a preliminary investigation. Only four have been suspended. Only four have been suspended with pay. Again, 104 officers posted violent, prejudicial, meaning that they were advocating something like what they call extrajudicial murders and other type of violence and racist messages. This did not happen in the bubble. This is part of the culture of the Dallas police. Don't be fooled because they got a black police chief because the last one was black.
Yeah, that's another thing that we also see, Scotty, in these cities that have been troubled by racist police actions. We often see that the higher-ups and the powerful people who make decisions appoint an African-American person. And what it actually reminds me of, and this is what I like about Black Talk Radio Network, it reminds me of the black overseers on the plantation. They have decided that if they pick a black person who has to enforce white people's rules on black people, that it somehow absolves the white people with power from their racism. He is, in fact, a black veil over the racism, because when you complain, they're going to say, well, he's black. And so people who are unfamiliar with slave culture may not understand that a lot of the whippers were actually slaves themselves. And, of course, we have words in African-American society for that type of behavior. I'm not going to necessarily use the label of handkerchief head or Uncle Tom on those type of appointees, but I am going to say that the sentiment is there to help cover up the racism. And it's important for men of color who find themselves, Latino men, African-American men who find themselves appointed to these positions after a suspicious event occurs, that they work to solve it and to give that the event that's perceived as a social injustice more credence, more like. That's actually how they're going to help instead of just cover up. So there's a fine line between helping and covering up. Scotty brought up a couple of things, and I just want the listeners to be aware of the black church burnings. And of course, if you watch a movie that's on, that you can get at the library, Eyes on the Prize, it was a series on public television. You can get Eyes on the Prize at the library. One of the things that they show is they document the civil rights movement, and one of the Klan's tools was to burn churches. And of course, bombing the church in Alabama where the little girls died is a movie that Spike Lee made. So black churches are burning again in America is an article that I found on Neighborhood Funders Group. I'm reading a little bit from the article and tie it back into the sentiment of violence where we are actually targeted. And to Scotty's point, if the white officers are not made accountable for their racist behavior on social media, then we can all be assured, I think it's a reasonable deduction, that they're going to have racist behaviors in their everyday interactions with African Americans. I personally, and I don't normally disclose my personal opinions, I try to present facts, but I personally believe that Amber Geiger's filter was simply based on the color of the person that she'd seen in her apartment. Had she seen a Latino woman watching TV and feeding her children ice cream, I'm not so sure she would have left, given what Scotty has informed me of her racist post. She probably would have called INS or detained them herself. And of course, this has resulted into a tragedy. People cannot get their family members back. So it's important for people to know, thoughts designate how you're going to interact or react. Your paradigm governs your behavior. So we know that this behavior of hers, it's couched in police power. It's couched in racism. I'm comfortable saying that. And because the family is from the island, black people from the Caribbean don't process white people in America the same way that you and I would, Scotty, because they don't have, they haven't grown up with institutional racism. So I think that without disrespecting the family, I'm simply saying that had the family grown up here, they might have a different perception of her actions. So just a little bit of background in the 10 minutes we have left about church burnings. If you're following me, you can go to nfg.org/news/black-churches/whole-thing. Churches are burning again in America. This article appears in The Atlantic, and it begins, it's written by Emma Green. What's the church doing on fire? Jeanette Dudley, the associate pastor of God's Power Church of Christ in Macon, Georgia. I do want to point out that these churches are usually south of the Mason-Dixon line. It is an arson that is never solved, and the federal government has been very, very, very reticent about investigating these as civil rights crimes in this day and age. Jeanette Dudley, the associate pastor of God's Power of Christ in Church in Macon, Georgia, got a call a little after 5 a.m. on Wednesday, she told a local news TV news station. Her tiny church of about a dozen members had been burned, probably beyond repair. The Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco got called in, which has been the standard procedure for church fires since the late 1960s. Stepping away from the article, one of the things we promote on the show is public health solutions to these problems. And clearly, if the ATF has been investigating them since the 1960s, they're not investigating them as fires started by individuals and as a type of fire prevention. Investigators say they ruled out possible causes. This is the author again, Emma Green. Like an electric malfunction, most likely this was arson. That's what I just said. So the ATF is not showing up at black churches and saying, tell your Sunday school kids don't play with matches. They know that it's more than that. The very same night, many miles away in North Carolina, another church burned, Briar Creek Road Baptist Church, which was set on fire sometime around 1 a.m., investigators have ruled it an act of arson, the AP reports. According to the Charlotte Observer, they haven't yet determined whether or not it might be a hate crime. We'll read a little bit more about the background of these church burnings and go back to our discussion about Amber Geiger and the Dallas police. Two other predominantly black churches have been the target of possible arson this week. Glover Grove Missionary Baptist Church in Warrenville, South Carolina, which caught fire on Friday. College Hill Seventh-day Adventist, which burned on Monday in Knoxville, Tennessee. Investigators in Knoxville told a local news station that they believed it was an act of vandalism, although they aren't investigating the incident as a hate crime. There have been at least three other cases of fires at churches this week at Fruitland Presbyterian Church in Gibson County, Tennessee, and the Greater Miracle Temple Apostolic Holiness Church in Tallahassee, Florida. Officials suspect the blazes were caused by lightning and electrical wires, respectively, but investigations are still ongoing. A church that is not predominantly black, College Heights Baptist Church in Elyria, Ohio, was also burned on Saturday morning. The fire appears to have been started in the sanctuary, and WKYC, and that's the television station I watch here in Cleveland, where we're broadcasting from, reports the cause is still under investigation. The town's fire and police department did not immediately return calls for confirmation on Sunday. These fires joined the murder of 9 people of Charleston's Emmanuel African and Methodist Episcopal Church as major acts of violence perpetrated against predominantly black churches recently. So this is an ongoing crime. This is an ongoing, black people are being targeted. Our structures, our places of worship continue to be targeted. And the article makes the point about the Charleston Emmanuel African and Methodist Episcopal Church murderer, Dylan Roof, because it escalated. One thing about Dylan Roof, of course, is he killed nine people at Bible study, and he does not commit arson on the church, but he is now on death row in the state of South Carolina. If you just tuned in, it is 11:54 a.m. You're listening to Victims to Victorious on the Black Talk Radio Network. Now, at the beginning of the show, we were discussing Amber Geiger, her victim, and the man who testified against her, whose name is Joshua Brown. And Scotty and I were both discussing the laws in Texas. And one of the themes of this show is that public policy, legislators in particular, can impact the level of gun violence, not by making guns more accessible, but by making guns less accessible. And Sally alluded to some of the gun laws in Texas, and I just want to give out some facts and figures about Texas in the 5 minutes that we have left. We do have time for a caller, 704-802-5056, 704-802-5056. If you don't get on the air, you can go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, look for Victims to Victorious, and leave a comment. So in Texas, as of this writing, 1.4 million gun permits have been issued. Texas is a state with 28.7 million people. I am on the usconcealedcarry.com website. The minimum age for concealed carry is 21. Your permit is valid for 5 years. There are 37 reciprocating states, and the summary of Texas gun laws, again, from the usconcealedcarry.com website. Texas is a shall-issue state, with concealed weapon permits issued at the state level by the Department of Public Safety. There is no permit, background check of firearms registered required when buying a handgun from a private individual. Stepping away from the article, Washington, D.C. differs from that, and gun advocates want to see more states ask that a background check be done between private sales. The private sales are regulated even more because, of course, you can draw, you can connect the dots between private gun sales and guns that are hard to trace that are used in crimes. Open carry is only legal with a Texas license to carry. It's called LTC, or concealed carry license permit from a state with reciprocity, provided the handgun is in a shoulder or belt holster. The minimum age is 21 years old or 18 years old for active duty military. Concealed carry is legal with a Texas LTC or concealed carry license permit from a state that Texas honors. Texas's LTCs are issued to both residents and non-residents. I want you to get your mind around that. They require 4 to 6 hour training courses, as well as passing both a written exam and a shooting proficiency demonstration. Some areas are off limits, including racetracks and secure areas of airports. In terms of reciprocity, Texas honors permits from states that meet specific criteria. It doesn't go into that. Texas is a castle doctrine, meaning stand your ground state. Texas law presumes you acted responsibly and justifiably if you use deadly force to protect yourself against an unlawful forceful intrusion into your occupied habitation. And of course, that does not apply to Amber Geiger. She opens the door herself to find someone in what she believes to her to be in her apartment. Certainly, the public sentiment would be different for her if an African-American man breached the door in her apartment, but she is actually the intruder in Botham's apartment. She is actually the intruder. He is where he's supposed to be, safe and sound and on the ground. So Texas is a state where we have seen mass shootings. Texas is a state where we have seen this unusual trial of a white female policeman killing someone in his own apartment. Her defense is she thought it was her own apartment. Let's stop gun violence. This is an epidemic. This is an epidemic that public health officials can resolve. Let us know how you would like to resolve gun violence. Follow me on Twitter, On Air Angel. That's On Air Angel. Post a message on the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. Look for my show, Victims to Victorious. We will be back next week. And I want to thank my sound engineer and founder of Black Talk Radio Network, Scotty Reed.